Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here as usual. And so this talk will be an overview of work done in the past year or so in collaboration with David Gaiotto, who's a student at Princeton, Ashok Sen, and Barton Zwieback. And this subject by its nature is very technical, but I'll try to give more of an overview rather than delving into technical details. I'm happy to ask questions in private if you have more technical questions. So I'd like to start with a very general slide of motivations. What is open string field theory and why we care? So open string field theory, we introduce a string field psi, which is an object that collects all the modes of the open string, and attempt to write some kind of second quantized space-time action that controls the word value dynamics of some D-brain. So the string fields, now in modern language, we think about living on some D-brains. And so this is the word volume dynamics governed by this second quantized action. So in this talk, we'll focus on the famous proposal of Witten from 86, cubic bosonic open string field theory. So everything I will say today, in fact, will be within the framework of the bosonic string, partly because the kind of questions we are trying to answer are of a conceptual nature. So the bosonic string is a good starting point, and the technical details become quite hard as you move to the superstring, but there has been some recent work. So in principle, if you really know what you're talking about, if you really know how to define the space of open string fields, and if you have a second quantized action, well, doing path integrals over this variable completely defines the theory non-perturbatively, much, say, at least at this very naive level as in QCD. Of course, there's a big if here. You must be able to give a precise characterization of this path integral by some regularization procedure. So of course, if you have a second quantized action, many of the ascending problems of string theory should be easier to tackle. And this was one of the motivations of the old work. You should be able to study the question of vacuum selection, the question of background independence in an easier way if you have a second quantized formulation. So this theory was studied intensely in the 80s, and there's a famous old result. The theory correctly reproduces the perturbative on shell amplitudes. There is a rather mysterious and intriguing fact here. So we know that we consider an amplitude which contains external open strings, there is a kinematical limit in which the amplitude is dominated by closed string poles. An annulus diagram, a one loop, can look like a long cylinder in a certain limit. And the miracle is that although we did not introduce any explicit closed string variables in the theory, somehow the theory manages to give you the correct on-shell amplitudes, which certainly contain contribution coming from closed string poles. So what happens in this theory that closed string states are better thought of as certain singular open string functionals. They are not independent degrees of freedom, but rather should be thought of gauge invariant operators of the theory. So in some sense, closed strings are an emerged concept, a derived concept in the theory, and that's conceptually very nice. At the same time, if you want to get the closed string physics out of this theory, you have to work extra hard, because the closed string theory, the closed string physics is encoded in some singular open string configurations. So I think people sort of lost interest at some point in the 80s, because it seemed like all you could do with this huge machinery was just get what you already knew from string perturbation theory in a complicated way. So what sort of got people a little bit excited more recently is the fact that not only the theory does seem to reproduce the correct leading perturbative results, but even have the first semi-classical physics, the correct first semi-classical physics. So you can get D-brains as solitons of open string field theory. So in particular, in this fantasy path integral that I'm trying to define non-perturbatively, at the semi-classical level, you'd get the correct contribution from D-brains. So So this was triggered, of course, by Sen's ideas about tachyon condensation. In some sense, one should think of D-brains as made of open string tachyons, various solitonic configuration of open string tachyon in this classical theory of open string represent D-brains, and in particular that implies a detention case like 1/2 the open string coupling square, which is what you expect for a sort of standard field theoretic soliton. So the real progress of the last year or so has been learning how to solve the classical dynamics of the theory. So since Sen told us what we should look for, it has become possible to actually find the solitons in the open string field theory and to solve the equation of motion by various numerical techniques. And in fact, the theme of this talk is, you know, that there are in fact also some kind of you know, by now still quite primitive analytic approaches to the problem. So of course, the big question that one should ask oneself is, given this, can one promote open string field theory to a full non-perturbative definition of string theory? But I think it's reasonable for now to try to completely understand and hopefully solve exactly the classical dynamics of the theory. So there's been quite a bit of technical progress recently, and it's really impossible to cover all of it in one talk. But so I will choose a specific pathway through the subject, which is I will focus on the projector equation. So by which I mean the two string fields that start to a string field that starts to itself. Now I haven't really told you yet what the star product is. It's famous width and star product, and all the details will come in a moment. So those of you who are familiar with the subject will recognize that the actual equations you have, the actual classical equation you have to solve, are different from this equation. There is an insertion of the BRST operator here, and this equation is a lot easier. So that's the first motivation why you want to solve this equation first. Since we do not quite know what to do with this, well, we study a toy problem. But in fact, this toy problem turns out to be exactly solvable. But in fact, what got us into this business was a more physical point of view. I will briefly review a conjecture about what is the structure of the theory around the point where the tachyon has condensed and there are no D-brains. And essentially, around that point, the equations of motion drastically, we propose that in some sense, to be explained in more detail later, the equations of motion essentially collapse to projector-type equations. And so then solitonic solution of this equation are then interpreted as D-brains in our proposed version of the theory, which we call vacuum string field theory. And then you can solve the equation and check several physical properties that, in some sense, test our simple proposal. I should actually mention another motivation at this point. This is sort of the physics one is after, but there are also more formal reasons why you may be interested in open string field theory. Certainly, it's as this will come at the end of the talk. This is a very interesting example of non-commutative field theory. In fact, in some sense, it goes one step beyond non-commutative field theory in the sense that it's much more complicated structure, and it's hopefully contains a closed string field, so it's not certainly a standard open string field theory. But if you are interested in non-commutative field theory, you should be interested in open string field theory because the structure here is even richer. So in this talk, I will briefly review Witten open string field theory. I will briefly talk about this proposal for how to simplify the theory around the vacuum, the stable vacuum of the tachyon, and then go on to this two points of view about projectors, a more abstract conformal field theory point of view in which you think of projectors as essentially finite conformal transformations acting on the vacuum. These are associated with surface states. And what's nice about this description is that you don't care about the details of the string background you're describing. These are just Virasoro operators, which are common to all backgrounds. I mean, they exist in all backgrounds, of course. And a more explicit formulation in which instead you commit yourself to a flat space background, and write your answers for projectors as some kind of squeeze state, an exponential bilinear of flat space bosonic oscillators. And in fact, there has been quite a bit of progress in this second approach here in terms of understanding how to multiply things using oscillators that comes from an exact diagonalization of the vertex matrix, which I will talk about at the end. So, of course, there are many details here that, for those of you who are not familiar with the subject, may be obscure, but this is just to give an orientation, and I will now go into more detail explaining some of the background. So here is the action that Wittgen proposed. So psi is the string field. So again, this collects all the modes of the open string. So for those of you who are not familiar with the subject, let's, for example, if you commit yourself to flat background, you can give an expansion of this object into a basis of standard Fock space oscillator. So you start out with the tachyon, which is a C1 operator acting on the vacuum, and then you have your gauge field, and then you have a bunch of confusing modes that you have never seen before, probably if you have never done open string field theory, because when you go on shell, these are projected out by the physical state condition. So going off shell does two things for you. Of course, it relaxes the condition that p squared should be equal to m squared, but it also introduces a lot of new auxiliary modes that you must keep off shell. So that's the open string field. This inner product is a standard inner product of the conformal field theory, and QB is the BRST operator. So this action has a Chern-Simons type form, where the star product is identified as a in this analogy as a wedge product, and the BRST operator is the zero differential. So it has the standard non-abelian gauge invariant. You can see that this makes sense because at the linearized level, your equation of motion say that the string field is killed by the BRST operator. That's, of course, the in going to the second quantized formulation, the physical state condition becomes equation of motion. And then the gauge invariant says you should identify fields which differ by things which are QB of something else. And that's, of course, the standard BRST cohomology. To complete the definition of the theory, I need to tell you what is the star operation. So I need to tell you how do you compute the overlap of three open string modes. And this is explained by this picture. I represent open string modes as in this canonical way. I will represent each of the modes by specifying a vertex operator insertion in the upper at the origin of the upper half plane. So I pick a base of those modes in this way. And then to compute the overlap of three of them, I will map these three vertex operators onto the unique disk with the specific conformal map. You can explicitly write down, which is the simple map that squeezes this half disk into one third of this pi. So this is the only prescription, it turns out, that gives you an associative product, and that's the condition for this action to be gauge invariant. Now, the space-time interpretation is also clear. So open strings propagate radially. So here you have open strings that join at the midpoint. So let me say that again in a different language, from a functional language point of view. So before I was talking of psi as an element of the first quantized Hilbert space. That's, of course, just saying that when you second quantize, you promote dynamical variables, the quantum states of your open string. And of course, this H includes both matter and ghosts in this covariant formulation we are using. But if you allow me to ignore ghosts for the sake of this transparency, well, equivalently, you go to a Schrödinger representation. Instead of thinking of this psi as a state in the Hilbert space, you can use you can think of it as a functional of open string configuration. So you give me an open curve, an open string curve, and this is a machine that for any curve gives a number. So what we'll do, we'll single out the midpoint and think of this machine that gives number as a machine that acts on the left and the right part of this open curve. And then the prescription to compute the star product is that the star product of such two functionals, again, I must tell you what is the value on a left and right half curves, can be obtained by multiplying psi 1 and psi 2, where the left part of psi 1 is the same as here, this red object, and the right part of the product is the same as the green object here, and you're functionally integrating over the right part of 1 and the left part of 2. So in pictures, that's what you're doing. You're identifying these brown curves, and the operation is, again, gluing at the midpoint. So you have two OpenString curves. They collide together in space-time, and their overlap is zero unless the right part of the first curve exactly overlaps with the left part of the second curve. So if you think about the star product in this language, it is some kind of matrix multiplication, where the first index of the matrix is the left part, and second index of the matrix is the right part, and the product is indeed summing over this intermediate index. So there is a sense in which you should be able to think of the star product as an operator multiplication in the space of half-string curves, although, of course, you have to work to make this precise. So again, you should think about the Witten action as the theory that defines, as the action defines the full world volume dynamics of open strings that live on some D-brain. So which D-brain are we talking about? Of course, we can specify backgrounds in many ways in string theory. Well, in order to even talk about the string field, you must tell me in which space, in which Hilbert space, the string field takes value. So you must specify a reference boundary conformal field theory knot that defines your background. And then all the objects I was showing in the Pearson transparency, this inner product, this triple overlap, are computing using correlators of this specific conformal field theory. That's the way you input into the theory the information about the background. So for simplicity, you could take just the standard open strings in the 26th dimension, which in modern language we think of the strings on a D25 brain. So, of course, Sen said that the open string, that this theory has a tachyonic instability, and Sen's interpretation of it is, with hindsight, very obvious. This simply means that the D brain is unstable. And what should happen is that there is a if you plot in some schematic way this tachyon potential, there must be a stable point somewhere, which corresponds to the vacuum where the brain has annihilated. So this implies that you must be able to find a solution psi bar of the Witten equations of motion that correspond to this tachyon vacuum. So it is a nice fact that this tachyon conjugate psi bar is in fact universal. It does not depend on any of the details of the background you started with, in the sense that there is a consistent truncation of the equations of motion to the subset which is generated just by Virasoro and ghosts. So you can actually write down your solution in this universal base, in the same for all backgrounds, and it's obtained. So I'm showing you some numerology here. These are numbers obtained by this other miraculous procedure in which you take this horribly complicated action. You chop the string field to the first few modes, and then crank, within a computer, and find the expectation values of these fields. And the procedure beautifully, at least it seems, for the first few levels, to convert, to stabilize to a finite limit, and you find a numerical solution. In fact, we recently pushed this very far with Davide, and if you. There are some interesting results, but they belong to a different talk, really. So I'm happy to discuss it later. In fact, there are further constraints that come from a further symmetry of the ghost theory. But the thing is, this universal tachyon condense clearly is the solution of some well-defined combinatorial problem. And eventually, somebody should find an exact solution. And in my view, this is really the outstanding open problem.
If you had only the first term on the right, That coefficient was 1, and you didn't have any other terms.
Excuse me, which right?
In your solution, your universal solution, psi bar.
Yes.
That would.
If you only had the tachyon, that's what you mean.
Is that the vacuum for the background that you're starting with?
No, the vacuum for the background is 0.
It's 0.
It's at 0.
You're just turning on a tachyon, basically.
Yeah. So what happens? This tachyon wants to roll down, so you start giving a F to the tachyon by the equation of motion driving to condensation, an infinite tower of extra modes. Again, this is, I think, a nice combinatorial problem that should be solved, but in the lack of an exact solution, the best that we could do is to try to guess the form of the action expanding around this tachyon vacuum. And a few things are clear. Well, if you the action obtained by shifting to the new vacuum clearly has the same form as the original action with only a different kinetic operator. Simply, the equation of motion, the action is cubic. If you shift, you're bound to get a cubic action back. And this Q bar will just contain the original BRC operator plus a term which is linear in your solution, obviously. So you can try to guess what this new Q bar should be. And a bunch of formal properties are obvious, simply from the fact you're shifting by classical solution, you have nil potency, the fact that this guy's derivation of the star algebra and it behaves nicely with respect to the inner product. But then you want to input the physics of this new vacuum. And the physics of the new vacuum is that since it's the vacuum where the debris has disappeared, you are supposed to have no open sinks around anymore. So by the more precise statement is that there should be no plane wave solutions of the linearized equations of motion. You should not be able to get perturbative asymptotic states in the new vacuum. So formally, that means that the new BRC operator must have 0 cohomology. And moreover, it should not depend on the background you started with because, again, there's this universality at work. So it's quite interesting that, in fact, there is an extremely simple answer, which is simply in the ghosts, that works. The really non-trivial part is that it's a derivation of star. The rest is very obvious, in particular the fact that the cohomology is 0. If you allow me to take, for simplicity, the case in which I take C0, well, it's clear that since C0 has an inverse, which is B0, anything which is killed by C0 can be written as C0 of something else. So there is no non-trivial cohomology in the game. In fact, we were confused for a while about which specific choice of coefficients should be picked. And finally, we made up our mind. What you should do is to pick up, to take a canonical choice in which you insert the ghost at the midpoint. This choice is, there are several ways to see that this is the correct choice. The way we arrived at it was that we were requiring the new action to have classical solutions corresponding to D-brains, and one can see that if solutions exist with a specific choice of gauge, which we call the so-called Siegel gauge, then that imposes constraints on the form of Q. And the idea is, if you find a solution, if you find a solution of the gauge fixed equations of motion, then this solution cannot be a solution for arbitrary BRST operator because the full equations of motion impose more constraints. Yes. Yes.
So it sounds like you're making a stronger statement in making this ansatz for Q. I mean, this universality, because you could imagine starting with a curved background, say, with the 25 grain, and then you would say, well, okay, the D25 grain decays, and you still have closed strings propagating this curved background.
Sure.
So you're assuming that this Q doesn't depend on closed string modes.
Okay, I was probably not very precise when we're making these claims. So the closed string background is fixed once and for all. So what you can meaningfully do, at least at the classical level with this theory, is to shift the open string background. So you pick your closing background as you please. You have some deep brains in this background. The condensation point is the point where the closing background hasn't changed, and you are changing the open string boundary conditions. So that's okay. So maybe your question is, where is the dependence on the closing moduli encoded in this action? Well, certainly it's encoded, for example, in the star product. There are formal arguments that people maybe made many years ago that the witness approach should be completely background independent. But this formal argument certainly failed for closing moduli deformations. Certainly, I think it can be consistently argued that the open string star product is, in a well-defined sense, open string background independent, but that's not true for the closed string moduli. So, I don't know if you want me to get into this. This is a rather nice geometrical picture for this, but it's so the idea is, well, you should think of your moduli space. So first of all, if you ask a question of background independence, you have to be a bit precise, because what do you mean that the theory is becoming independent? What do you mean is that if you formulate the theory around two different backgrounds, there is a theory definition that maps the two theories. But I was trying to emphasize, even the variables of the theory are different because they live in different Hilbert spaces. So in order to compare at all two different backgrounds, you must think more geometrically. You have some kind of connection on moduli space. You have a base space, which is your base, which is your moduli space. At each point in your base, there is a fiber, which is the Hilbert space of the conformal field theory at that point in moduli space. And you know, if you want to start even thinking about background independence, you have to tell me how you're going to compare a point in this fiber with a point in that fiber. And what actually happens is a rather nice story, is that for the open string moduli, you can define a connection over this open string moduli space, which behaves nicely with respect to the star product. It's a derivation of the star product. So that means that if you can show background independence, at least infinitesimally, simply by parallel transporting. If you start with the theory defining the point in moduli space, BSFT, a certain boundary conformal field theory, you parallel transport the variables, the states, according to this connection. This is just a Leibniz rule. And the parallel transported action is the same. That's the same of moduli independent, of background independent. That there is a way to redefine variables, which in this case is just a simple parallel transport that makes the two theories equivalent. But certainly, this has not been done for the closing moduli. I don't think there is any good reason to believe that the theory should, at least at the classical level, should be independent of the closing background. So I don't know if that answers your question. So. Anyway, I'm sorry, this was... this choice can be motivated from several points of view. It is a bit singular, and in fact, this is a point that I want to really emphasize. At least in my point of view, this is not the theory of everything or anything. It's a simple ansatz that has some good properties, but it's clearly somewhat singular, and I will try to motivate what I mean. The origin of a singularity shortly. And nevertheless, it so happens that even with this rather singular choice of midpoint insertion, you can do many calculations by choosing a specific regularization. So what actually happens in a regulated sense, this number is infinite, which means you introduce a regulator, you get a finite number. As you remove the regulator, this number blows up, but you can meaningfully do computation in the regulated theory, and many things work out. In particular, you find classical solution corresponding to the brains, and you check their properties. So the message that I would really like to convey at this point is that essentially, the equations of motion in this vacuum sim field theory are projector equations. So There is this Q, which is a pure ghost insertion, but you should think of it as just some minor kinematic nuisance that's used to account for properly for ghost number conservation. Really, these are projector equations. And let me make this more precise by explaining something which, I'm sorry, is going to be slightly more technical. So from several points of view, you like to think of the equations of motion in the new vacuum as projector equations. Well, I think independent of open string theory, there are reasons to believe that the brains are classified by projectors. Well, clearly, this is nice, but it clashes immediately with ghost number conservation. So in my conventions, in which the SL2R vacuum has ghost number one, the physical states in the theory have ghost number, the ghost number vacuum is ghost number zero. The physical states of the theory, I have ghost number one, and the star and ghost number is additive under star product. So you clearly cannot do this if psi is belongs to a ghost number one space. And indeed, the equation of motion are organized in such a way that you really need a BRST operator which has ghost number one for this ghost number counting to work out. So how are we going to go around this problem? Well, there's a very natural thing you can do. You can construct an auxiliary ghost system, B prime and C prime, by twisting the original system. So you shift the stress tensor by this topological twist, which involves the derivative of the ghost number current. And this is a well-known theory, which has central charge minus 2, and where the new B as conformal dimension 1 and C as conformal dimension 0, and the new SL2R vacuum is the old zero momentum tachyon vertex operator. So in the new auxiliary system, it's natural to think of the tachyon as having ghost number 0. And then the claim is that if you write the equations of motion in this twisted theory, in this auxiliary twisted system as projector equations, then there is a one-to-one map between solution of this auxiliary equations of motion and the original vacuum symphony theory equation of motion, where this Q is precisely the ghost insertion at the midpoint. And there's a very simple way to understand this. This topological twist does nothing if the curvature is zero, because the topological twist is understood from the conformal theory point of view by adding a term, topological term to the BC action. It does something if you have a curvature, and in computing the width and star product, all the curvature is considered in the midpoint, and that then naturally you pick up a ghost insertion at the midpoint when you relate this auxiliary star prime product to the original product of the theory. So anyway, this is probably too technical, more technical than I really wanted to get into, but the message here is that there is a sense in which you can think of the equations of motion on the new vacuum as projector equation, a rather precise sense, in fact. So then a comment on what this all means. So what you really should do in life is to solve the Witten equations, and then you shift to the new theory. And on general grounds, you may expect the new kinetic term to be some sum with complicated coefficients, maybe, of an integral of local operator. This is really not saying anything. But the point now is that you can dramatically simplify this complicated object if you make a singular change of coordinates, which amounts to a reparametrization of the open string coordinate that squeezes things towards the midpoint. If you do such a squeeze in a symmetric way and with this further condition, you can show that the cubic term doesn't change. This is because you are, you can check that this condition preserves the half-string overlaps of open curves. So you're making a theory definition that preserves the fact that the theory is cubic, and you're only changing the kinetic term. How are you changing the kinetic term? Well, These local operators will get, if you assume that they're primaries, I mean, if they're not, you should ask the terms, but the argument still goes through. They will get multiplied by the derivative of this function at the midpoint. But the derivative of this function at the midpoint is going to zero because I'm taking some singular representation which I squeeze things an infinite amount towards the midpoint. And the only operator that survives is the only operator of negative conformal dimension, which is just the ghost. So this simple argument shows that there is a limit in which the theory precisely reduces to our ansatz, in fact, also with a singular overall coefficient. So I think the more, I mean, one way to understand the success of our story is that although this is a singular limit, several physical quantities can be computed in the limit and do not care about the subleading terms that you should add to the singular operator as you take the limit. So, of course, you can still wonder if there are questions that depend on the subleading terms, and so far, well, it's so far, in fact, the miracle is beyond my expectation. Every check has been made, it seems to work. But at some point, you may have to face the fact that you need a more precise definition of this singular limit, a more precise regularization procedure. Another point, which I hope to will become clear later, is that as you take this infinite squeezing limit, regular Fock states become projectors. So it's very natural then the equations of motion are just projector equations. And I hope I'll come back to this later. So OK, this was my sort of first half of general overview. If there are no questions, I'll go on to really talking about projectors. So again, now I will sort of somewhat change style. Let's leave a little bit of the physics behind, and now we just simply want to solve this equation for its own sake. So for simplicity, I will assume that this equation is a question in the full Matter-Plus Gauss-Hilbert space with central charge zero. If you are interested in applications to vacuum symphyl theory, at the end you should take this Gauss number zero. Okay, and again, Gauss number conservation forces this to be a Gauss number zero. If you're interested in application of vacuum symphyl theory, after you have found the solution, you have to make this topological twist of the ghost, and that will automatically promote this ghost number zero equation to a ghost number one solution of the vacuum symphyl theory equations. And rank n projectors will have the physical interpretation of configurations with nd brains. So the point of view that I would like to emphasize here in this part of the talk is that there is a simple geometric way to think about this projector equation, which simply uses general tools of conformal field theory. You can look for solutions in the subalgebra of surface states. What is a surface state? Well, we pick a Riemann surface with the topology of a disk and a puncture, so one puncture of disk, with a choice of local coordinates. So that's in the data of the definition of the surface. Local coordinates are, what I mean by local coordinates, there is, again, my canonical upper half plane where I define my Betzdorf of open string states. And I have a map from this C plane, which is the local patch, to the U global plane where the whole disk is defined, and the map defines some local coordinates around this function. So if you define your surface state, this is what a one puncture disk is. How do we associate a state in the conformal field theory? Well, in the standard way. For any local operator phi, I will compute the overlap by the following prescription. I take phi, my favorite canonical basis at the origin of the upper half plane, and I map it to the puncture using the local coordinate, and then compute the one-point function on this disk. So since this prescription defines the overlap of the state for any local operator, this defines the state. Of course, there are several several equivalent representations of the same surface state which are related by conformal transformation. So for simplicity, and because this is actually particularly convenient, I will make a canonical choice. So again, this is my local patch, my local C plane, where I define my canonical base of states by inserting them at the origin. And I always pick as local coordinates this SL2C transformation that maps this upper half disk to this vertical upper half disk. You can easily check. So this is point one, this is point zero in the W hat plane. So the information about which particular disk I'm talking about is then fully encoded. So the disk sigma hat is the whole disk. And R hat is this portion of the disk where I have removed this local coordinate patch. So the information about which particular surface I'm talking about is fully encoded in the shape of this R hat part. So again, you define states. You define the state associated with sigma by computing one-point function, the operator, which are mapped to this puncture using the local coordinates. So why is this useful? Well, because then it becomes a simple geometric game to do operations in this theory. Well, what is the inner product? If you think about it a moment, the inner product of the surface state with itself, you simply take the surface state, remove the local coordinate patch, and glue two copies by flipping it upside down. What I mean by this, you compute the partition function of the conformal field theory on this disk. Of course, if you are doing, as I was saying at the beginning, the case C equals zero, this is entirely trivial because the partition function is just one for all these shapes. But if you were to do this in the matter of conformal field theory, then this would carry information about the shape of the theory. The reason why it's zero, it's one in C equals zero case, that if C equals zero, you can freely do conformal transformation without picking any factor, and then you can map this just to the unit disk. But anyway, this is useful in other contexts. The star product of the surface state with itself is also very easy. Again, you take two copies of the surface state of this, the region R hat, which is the one that encodes the non-trivial information, strip out local coordinate pads, and then glue two copies of it in such a way, of course, that the right part of copy one is glued to the left part of copy two. That's what Witten told you to do. And then the local patch is again inserted in the resulting picture, and this is in this slide to come out of the slide. I hope that this picture is clear. So from this point of view, it may seem very miraculous that you're ever going to get projectors, because the challenge is find a shape that they, when you glue it onto itself, is going to come back to itself. And this seems essentially impossible. But of course, that is, well, there is, of course, a first simple solution that you can think about. And this is not the way we found it, but that's a useful way to think about. Start from the vacuum state. The vacuum state, if you think about it a moment, is associated to this picture. So this, the gray part is, again, my local patch, and I'm completing it to the unit disk. That's the vacuum in the theory. Begin to multiply it several times. As you multiply it by this prescription, you're building a helix of angle n times pi. And if you believe, and in fact, you can show quite precise that this object has a well-defined large n limit, you have found a solution, clearly, because the two infinite helix glued one after the other are again an infinite helix. In fact, you find this rather peculiar abelian algebra of what we call wedge states. And the infinite n limit is something which we call the sliver, which is just, in this language, an infinite helix. But it doesn't seem you can go much beyond that until you realize that, in fact, you should recall that all of these shapes are defined up to conformal equivalences. And there is a famous property of conformal maps that string theorists are used to in, for example, studying of factorization of string amplitudes, which is the following. Let's take a disk which is pinching. So a one-parameter family of this that as this parameter t reaches one, developed an infinitely small neck. So in this limit, this connects into region one and region two. And the claim is that there is a continuous family of conformal maps such that you can essentially absorb this part away, meaning this, that this map, this continuous map, is the identity on region one and maps the whole of region two to a point. Think about it, it's true. So again, you can, this sort of extra region is meaningless, really, from the conformal point of view, because you can just map it to a point by keeping region one entirely fixed. So it's then obvious what you should do to get projectors. To get projectors, you must take shapes that are such that the they're touching this midpoint on this half disk. And this is the string midpoint. Recall that string open string propagate radially, so this is the string midpoint. Not radially, I'm sorry. They propagate this way, but this is the string midpoint. Why is this a solution of the projector equation? Again, you are supposed to glue in such a way that B gets glued to A, and this is where you glue the half disk back. But by the conformal mapping theorem I was showing you before, this whole region here is irrelevant. In computing correlation functions of arbitrary state on this product, you can reduce it to the correlation function of the shape in which this is absorbed away. And then, of course, the new shape is simply the old one. So this gives you a geometric way to understand how projectors arise. And in fact, you can also convince yourself that these are rank one projector. What does it mean algebraically for a projector to be rank one? If you sandwich any state with two copies of the projector, you get something which is proportional to the projector up to, you know, to a number. That's what it means for the projector to be rank one, if you think about it for a second.
So are you adding an operator in H, or are you just sort of having the surface cut?
Here?
Yeah.
No, I'm not adding anything. I'm just having the surface just touches it. So so there is also another point of view that should make this very clear, which is the functional integral point of view. So you can, of course, represent states as open string functionals, again, the Schrödinger representation. And again, I'm for simplicity, let me focus on the Mellor part. How do you determine the function that corresponds to a specific, the value of the function on a specific open string curve X of sigma? Well, you take this portion of the surface states, R hat, where we have stripped out the local coordinate patch which was here, and you do a path integral where on this green line you input the data X of sigma. On this brown line, you put your favorite open string boundary conditions that depend on which background you're talking about, and then you do the path integral. So you're simply cutting open the path integral at this green line, and that defines a state in the usual way. So so that's the function that corresponds to this particular surface. Then, then it's obvious what's going on with our pinched surfaces. These are surfaces in which the functional of an open string configuration is a product of a function which only depends on the left part of the curve times a function which only depends on the right part of the curve. And here I'm using a language in which in which I'm parametrizing all open strings again from zero and pi. So So the fact that this says two sigma, it's my way of saying it depends only on the left part, and the fact that this says two times pi minus sigma is a way of saying that it depends on the right part. So you can think of these two functionals as defining states in half-string Hilbert space. So in half-sync Hilbert space, you have your space of half-sync curves, and these are, again, surface states in the half-sync Hilbert space, which are with a well-defined shape, which you can easily compute geometrically if you know the functions that define the original state. And in fact, you have to go through a little bit of gymnastic, but this shape here that defines the, let's say, the left part of your original state can be easily computed by doing a few conformal maps. You take this top region here, you go back with h minus 1, recall that h is my choice of local coordinate to the local patch. You account for the fact that you are reparametrizing coordinates from by multiplying by 2. From you want to parametrize things canonically from 0 and pi, and then you move back again to the global plane, and that's how you compute the surface. Briefly, let me also mention something which is quite clear. These surface states can be given a very explicit operator representation in terms of exponential Virasoro operators acting on the vacuum. This is simply because the action of this bra on any state is just the action of some finite conformal transformation, and that's just an exponential of the generators of the conformal group. And you can compute these coefficients by demanding that, you're just computing the vector field exponentiate the surface. This is just trivial, really. This will become important in a moment. This expression, which is linear in the Virasoro operator, is clearly bilinear in bosons. If you pick a standard flat space boson for your X field, and this matrix here is related in some known way to this function F you're talking about. So this is really not. So let me mention an interesting state that we came across, which we call the butterfly state. In my canonical way of representing states in this W hat plane, the butterfly is simply a disk with a cut here. So these points C and D are really coincident. So this state is clearly split into a left and a right part. So again, I'm imposing open string boundary condition all around here. And the butterfly is defined where this angle here is really zero. So it's just I'm going this and this and back again. So why is it interesting? Well, there's a very simple expression in terms of Virasoro operators. You may not care too much about it, really. But what makes this state particularly canonical is that it's a tensor product of a left and a right half-string vacuum. How do you see that? You go through this conformal mapping gymnastics I was showing you before. You cut the top portion of the butterfly. You go back to the local patch with the inverse of H. You account for the fact that you are reparametrizing the curve to go from 0 and pi, so that turns this animal into this one. And then you go back to the global plane, so this region here has got map to the full left half disk, and this, as I was telling you before, is just the vacuum. So conclusion, the butterfly is the projector onto the half string vacuum. And in fact, quite miraculously, it appears to be the state we find in numerical computations in vacuum sync field theory using this level truncation business. It's generically the state that you encounter if you solve the projector equation numerically. So the application to vacuum sync field theory, you found the solution of the SQL zero equation, and now you want to interpret it as a one configuration with one B-brain. And the way you do it, you consider some matter boundary conformal field theory, and you tensor it with this twisted God system. So the total central charge is not zero. And you want to look for surface states in this auxiliary system with this auxiliary ghost PC system. And the way to do that is to take one of the standard solution, the C equals zero equation that I was showing you before, in which they were in terms of total VLSR generators, so they had a matter and a ghost term with equal coefficients, and you twist the ghost. Twisting the ghost means you replace the vacuum, the SL2R vacuum with C10, and the original ghost VLSR with prime VLSRs. And in the process, you also pick up a normalization, which typically turns out to be infinite. And that's related to the fact that the total central charge is not canceling out. And then the claim is that this twisted state, which now has the correct ghost number one, is a solution of the vacuum C-field theory equation with this singular midpoint ghost insertion. And it's actually quite convenient, technically, the fact that in this twisting procedure, the ghost part turns out to automatically obey Siegel gauge. But well, that's a technical comment. So I should mention that, of course, you can do this in your favorite matter conformal field theory, and that gives the configuration of one brain of that conformal field theory. So in this way, you have a simple way to understand how to obtain all possible D brains. It also tells you implicitly how you are supposed about to think of finding physical states around the D brain. What you should do is to make an infinitesimal deformation of the conformal field theory. And in fact, Okawa, we made this proposal that maybe because we weren't confident enough about it, we really didn't go very far with it, but you take one of these projectors, the way you do infinitesimal deformations is by integrating around the boundary where T parameterizes boundary, your favorite dimension one matter primary operator. You can convince yourself that this operation is in fact precisely this covariant derivative operation that is a derivation of the star product I was mentioning before in the context of moving around moduli space. So this is your. So if you take for O, say the dimension one tachyon vertex operator, I'm sorry, without the C, I'm just in the matter sector. This is your candidate state that describes the fluctuation, physical fluctuation of the D brain state. You are starting from the theory which has no brain. You found a vacuum that corresponds to the D25 brain. You want to see your open string fluctuations back. And at least formally, this guy obeys correctly the linearized field equations. And Okawa, in a rather nice paper recently, showed that with this definition, you are able to compute exactly the overall energy gap between the original vacuum and the old vacuum. So what was always the problem to compute this number is that you do not know what's the overall normalization in front of the action. You start from the theory around the vacuum which has no brain, how you're supposed to normalize things. Well, you must normalize things by telling me what is the open string coupling constant. How do you know what's the open string coupling constant? Well, you find a solution corresponding to the original brain, find the physical tachyon around it, and then compute the three-point function of three tachyons. And that's what defines the open string coupling constant. So by doing this procedure, you fix once and for all the overall normalization in front of the vacuum C-field theory action. And at this point, you have no freedom left. Either the energy gap between the D25 brain and the vacuum window brain comes out right, or it comes out wrong. And it comes out right. And this requires actually rather complicated calculation. It's a bit of a miracle. There must be a better way to understand it. But you get this factor of 2 pi squared that I never dreamt of getting, really. But there are some complicated integrals that gives it for you. How much time?
I think 3:15 is probably the hard cutoff, so 10 minutes.
I don't want to impose. I have a few more transparency, but anyway. So this pretty much concludes what I wanted to say about this abstract conformal field theory point of view, which is I think quite nice because many properties are can be sort of described in a very general setting. But you know, more schematically, I would like to mention that there has been progress recently in this other approach, in which you commit yourself to a choice of flat background. So what is the vertex? Well, the vertex is a machine that, given three bras, open string, that live in Hilbert space 1, 2, and 3, the vertex lives in the tensor product of Hilbert space 1, 2, 3. It's a machine which is an exponential of a bilinear form of oscillators, of creation operators that live in the three Hilbert space. So these green indices R and S come from 1 to 3 and label which Hilbert space, which of the three strings you're considering. And these red indices come from 1 to infinity and label the which mode of the open string you are looking at. And Gross and Zawiski computed these matrices. Well, they are very well known. I don't want to get into much detail here. But anyway, clearly, if you have any expression of for psi 1, psi 2, psi 3 in terms of oscillators, by doing enough commutation relation, you can reduce with this creation operator, you can compute this number. So that's a very concrete expression for the vertex. So how do you find projectors in this language? Well, it's very, very natural, given that the vertex is this bilinear form, to look for an ansatz which is a bilinear in the projectors, in terms of some infinite matrix T, whose indices again goes from 1 to infinity, and C by some matrix of 1s and minus 1, which is inserted for technical convenience. So this is what suggested by Cozzoletti and Potting, and they under this very crucial assumption that this matrix T commutes with the vertex matrices, you can carry out this computation in detail, and you find some answer, which is this one in terms of M, which is related to this to the vertex matrix, just V11, essentially. So it turns out that this is precisely this infinite helix surface state I was showing you before. But clearly, using this type of techniques, you can go ahead and compute quite precisely the tension of the brain. You can repeat this. If instead of having a D25 brain, you have a DP brain, you can do intersecting brains. You can do lots of things using this kind of techniques. But clearly, what I want to emphasize here, there's nothing miraculous about this, or nothing really special or mystical about this liver state. There are tons of solutions of these equations, and the way this was selected was because you imposed this very simple answer that this matrix commutes with the vertex matrices. And in particular, all these family of surfaces which are just shapes that pinch at the midpoint are described by some more complicated matrices. The last thing I want to mention to you briefly, really, that recently we were able to diagonalize these vertex matrices. So you can focus for simplicity on V11. So this matrix IRS, again, labeled the three open strings. Why is it useful to diagonalize the matrix? Well, because if you diagonalize them, you can go to the diagonal base, and the star product becomes really, really simple. And there is a very simple trick that actually works quite beautifully. Clearly, this matrix M, which is the part of the vertex in which you take R and S to be equal and to be one, for example, by cyclists, you could take 2, 2 or 3, of course. Well, you can read it off from the matrix that appears in the exponential, the star product of Tuvakia, and that's simply because the star product of Tuvakia is obtained by contracting two bra vacua with the vertex. And then you realize that this object is killed by this combination of Virasoro operators. And that's because K1 kills the SL2R vacuum, and it's a derivation of star. So that gives you a remarkable tool to diagonalize this matrix, because now you find that the action of this combination of Virasoro generators on the oscillators can be expressed as the action of this infinite matrix K1 acting on this infinite column of oscillators. And the fact that this kills this combination can be expressed in the statement that the vertex metric commutes with K1. But K1 is an extremely simple matrix. There's no problem in diagonalizing it. It has a spectrum of non-degenerate and continuous eigenvalues, which parameterize from minus infinity and plus infinity, and the eigenvectors entries can be very explicitly computed in terms of some generating functional. So again, these V kappa are eigenvalues with eigenvectors with eigenvalue kappa of this K1 matrix. Twist, which is simply the worksheet parity that sends signal to pi minus sigma, acts in this way. It, with a minus sign, it exchanges the sign of kappa. And it so happens that, of course, at kappa equals zero, I'm sorry, this matrix, this procedure maps an eigenvalue kappa bar with minus kappa bar, but at kappa equals zero, there's only one unpaired eigenvector, which turns out to be twist odd. For the vertex, so this is the spectrum. On this horizontal line, you can read the spectrum of K1. The spectrum of the vertex matrix M is plotted here, is this eigenvalue mu. And you see that this vertex matrix M being twist even, for any value of the eigenvalue of mu, there are two degenerate eigenvectors of opposite twist, except for this critical value minus 1/3, which is only one pair twist odd eigenvector. So this is probably, well, what I want to emphasize is that having reached this diagonalization basis, eigenvectors with different kappa commute. When you take the star product, you have reduced the star product to a tensor product of things that do not talk to each other. In fact, these results have been used to do exact computation. And one of the most remarkable developments was due to Douglas, Liu, Moore, and Zwieback, who realized that, in fact, using this basis, you can rewrite the star product as a tensor product, a continuous tensor product of Moyal products. So again, you start from the standard discrete basis in which you expand the open string, and you go to this continuous basis by this set of eigenvectors are a complete set, so you can compute, you can go to this continuous basis. In fact, it so happens that it's convenient to go to define X by using the even modes, and define Y by using the odd Fourier transforms of this mode X. This P2N minus 1 are the Fourier transform of the XN. And then the claim is that, well, the string field is a functional of this discrete XN, but you can think about it, of course, by simple change of base as a function of this continuous variable X of kappa and Y of kappa. And the claim is that now doing star products of this function is the same as doing Moyal products if you assume that the coordinate X and Y obey this commutation relation, where this theta parameter is related in this way to the kappa eigenvalue. Notice that for kappa equals zero, there is an extra coordinate that is unpaired, so there's no scope for a Moyal product there, and it's a commutative coordinate. So clearly, there's a connection between this and the half-string formalism. In fact, in my view, this is really the way to do the half-string formalism in a more mathematically sound way, because, well, if you have some operator interpretation in terms of half-strings, you can always think, if you want, these operators, quantum mechanical operators, and then it should sort of be clear that you can always rewrite that as some kind of Moyal, I mean, products of Moyal structure, and this is what this is doing for you. There's been lots of progress recently in this direction. People have done the ghosts, including momentum. You can do solitons, et cetera, but that goes beyond my talk. One last comment. I believe that this extra commutative coordinate is very crucial and is the one that gives the correct physics of moduli deformation of the solutions. So for example, if you consider the projector corresponding to D25 brain, naively, if you think you have an operator formalism, any projector is unitary equivalent to any other projector. You can rotate any rank one projector to any other rank one projector. But that's not the right physics, because D25 brains comes in various flavors. For example, they come dressed with Wilson lines. And that's what the Ampere non-commutative coordinate is doing for you. The dependence on the commutative coordinate cannot be gauged away by unitary transformations, because, well, no unitary transformation will change the commutative dependence. And if you count parameter, that's precise an algorithm parameter for the Wilson lines. And there are more precise arguments along these lines, but I'll stop here.
Thank Leonardo.
Thank you.